is, Justin, but you're about to find out. Noah springs forward into the room. Before Justin can do anything more than turn around, Noah plows into him, sending him sprawling, crashing into the wall. Noah grabs Justin and throws him face down on the cement floor, gripping his hair, shoving the gun into the back of Justin's neck.
"Where is she?" Noah growls.
"Noah?" Justin manages, catching his breath.
"Is that you? Tell me where she is, Justin, or I'll kill you right now."
His fingers tightly gripping Justin's hair, Noah jerks Justin's head upward and then down, hard, onto the cement floor.
"That's me being nice, Justin. You want to see me when I'm mean? This is your last chance," says Noah. "Where is Jenna Murphy?"
I'm looking for her too. I thought she might have come here."
Cool air to Noah's right. He looks over, shines his flashlight over the trap door, wide open.
"Did she go down there?"
"I'm telling you, I don't know."
"Don't bullshit me."
"I'm not bullshitting you."
Justin's voice weaker from the blow to his head.
What are you going to do to her?"
Noah presses the gun into the soft space between Justin's skull.
"You should be worried about what I'm going to do to you."
"Don't hurt her,"
Justin says.
"Please, Noah, just don't hurt her."
Noah leans down close to Justin's face.
"Justin, I can't tell if you're a liar or a fool."
He cracks Justin's head against the floor again. Justin goes limp with an abrupt groan. Noah stands and shines his flashlight along the walls, over the carpenter's desk. Some things hanging on the walls that could be helpful. Then he shines the light back down on Justin, unconscious but still breathing. He pats Justin down and feels something in the front pocket of his trousers. He removes a tiny gun, one of those old Saturday Night Specials, a beat-up vintage .38 with a pearl handle.
"I think I'll take this, Justin," he says.
He stuffs the little gun into his pants pocket, a nice compliment to his own gun.
"I haven't decided what I'm gonna do to you yet," he says. "Let's see how I feel after my nice, friendly chat with Jenna Murphy."
Chapter 116. I stumble through the door through which Aiden Willis just escaped, away from the smooth marble onto something different, the floor broken and dirty. Once I'm clear of the doorway, I slam the door behind me and take a deep, delicious breath of oxygen. The air is dry and stale, but I don't care. I'm breathing again on 2 feet again. I'm out of that awful room. "Come with me." I put one foot in front of the other, my legs unsteady but better, feeling better now. "Aiden!" I try to call out, my throat and mouth so dry I can hardly speak. A small room, it feels like, not open air. I'm reaching out for the walls when something slithers across my face. I jump back and wave my hand around, connect with it again. A string dangling in the air. I reach out, making my hand still, and the string falls back against my hand. I grip it and pull down. A light, a single naked overhead light comes on. Hanging from the walls, medieval weapons. Lances, stars, battle axes, cat-o'-nine-tails, maces. A full menu of torture devices. I shudder but shake it off. I need to figure out a way out of here. 3 of the 4 walls are covered with this weaponry, but 1 wall is naked. Nothing hanging on it. Nothing but smooth wood. Immediately next to it, on the adjoining wall, a small button. A buzzer? With a trembling hand, I press the button. I know, somehow, what will happen next. The wall slides open. I drop to a knee, my weapon useless now without any bullets, and click on the flashlight. A corridor. Naked walls. Concrete floor. The basement of 7 Ocean Drive. "Follow me. Come on. Aiden!" I call out, but I get no response. The hallway turns a sharp left into a giant room, just as dark as everywhere else in the basement. I shine my flashlight over the room, though the beam is weakening and I need to preserve the battery. "Aiden!" boxes, old furniture, photographs and artwork, the kind of stuff in any basement. And a staircase leading up. Come on, follow me. Be quiet. I approach the staircase slowly, not trusting my rubbery legs, my head throbbing like I have a hangover from being inside that room. I take the stairs just as carefully, lightly touching each step before transferring my weight, unsure of the stability of this staircase. When I reach the top of the stairs, the door is ajar. Aiden must have blown through here a few minutes ago. I take a breath and push the door open. I turn the corner and shine the flashlight, the dwindling beam, over the open foyer of the house. The front door is straight ahead of me, across the foyer and the two ornate anterooms. The words coming at me so fleetingly, like smoke, whispers. Run. Go. Get out of here. Run. Aiden! I call out again, my voice shakier this time, echoing upward. Nothing in response but a groan from this haunted mansion. I hear something upstairs, an elongated sigh. A house sound or a human sound? I take a step up the stairs. You don't want to go up there. Squeezing my eyes shut as if it will lock out the whispers between my ears. Don't come up here. Go. Leave. Don't come up here. Aiden, please talk to me. I cry. The pressure mounting inside my chest again. The momentary reprieve I felt after leaving that room vanishing in the snap of a finger. Everything returning like an avalanche. My heart pounding again, sweat on my face once more. Every step and effort, every instinct telling me to turn back, run out the front door. There's danger upstairs. But I move forward regardless, because I have to know. I have to finally know. Even if it kills me. I reach the landing on the second floor. The double doors open onto the second floor hallway. I walk through like I'm in slow motion, like I'm wading upstream. But I'm not stopping now. So I turn left and head toward the master bedroom. The bedroom where Melanie Phillips and Zach Stern were brutally tortured. Where various Holdens over the years committed brutal acts on others and on themselves. Aiden Willis! I call, forcing the words out. Aiden, I was wrong about you. I know that now. You saved my life that day. I remember now. You got me out of this house. Just please, please talk to me. One foot in front of the other down the ornate red and gold hallway, shining my dwindling flashlight beam in front of me until I reach the threshold of the master bedroom. Aiden, are you in here? I shine my light over the room. Empty. Nobody here. But near the bed, a lamp. Another kerosene lamp. The liquid full in the hourglass-shaped clear bowl. A short wick protruding from atop the metal dome. Next to it, a book of matches. I tuck my gun in the back of my pants and pin the flashlight between my arm and body. I strike the match and light the wick, producing a healthy orange glow about the room. Light. Precious light as my flashlight is on the verge of dying. I head to the corner of the room, to the French doors and the wraparound corner balcony outside. I push open the French doors, cool air hitting my face. The wind swirling, and look out over Ocean Drive to the west. I see a glimpse of him, the signature straw hair, the slight hunch to his posture. Aiden Willis running north on Ocean Drive, away from the Atlantic, from this house, from me and my questions, and disappearing into the woods. I lean against the railing, the wind playing with my hair, my eyes fixed on that point where Aiden ducked into the woods. I'll never catch up with him. He's too far ahead and much more familiar with every nook and cranny of this town. Come here, he said to me as a boy. Follow me. I'm trying to pull more from that memory, but the more I reach for it, the farther away it gets. I shake my head. It's no use trying to force it. It's like turning on high beams to see through fog. It only muddies it up more. I remember his face, remember his words, remember the relief sweeping through me when he guided me out of that basement and up those stairs. But then what? I whisper. And why? Why did Aiden come through Justin's window the other night and try to attack me with that knife? Deflated, defeated, I push myself off the railing. I curve around the corner to enter the bedroom from the south, where Noah Walker stands, training a gun on me. Chapter 117.
Don't move, Murphy. Don't move or I'll shoot.
I show him my empty hands. The flashlight left behind on the bed. Justin's revolver stuffed in the back of my pants, which he can't see. Focus, Murphy. Assess. Assess the situation. I'm on the balcony by the railing. Noah is maybe 8-10 feet away, inside the room, but just at the entrance to the balcony. The lamp behind him is sufficient to give me a decent look at his features. His eyes narrowed from the wind licking his face, stinging his eyes. His face crumpled up in anger, the gun trembling in front of him. Anger? At me? For screwing up his plans? I guess he was having a pretty easy time killing people before I came along.
I should kill you right now,
he hisses. What's stopping you? I say. My eyes cast about for options, but it's pitch black out here on the balcony. About my only option is jumping from the balcony and hoping I avoid the spiked fence, hoping I survive with just some broken bones. Or charging him. He doesn't look that comfortable holding that gun. Most of the people he killed were cut or stabbed or impaled. Maybe firearms aren't his thing. Still, he's so close to me. He couldn't miss me if he tried.
I have a few questions, he says.
And you think I'm gonna answer them?
Yeah, I do, he says, because I still haven't decided whether I'm going to kill your boyfriend, Justin.
Justin? Roped into this because of me. Justin has nothing to do with this, Noah. Leave him out of it. Noah pauses.
He doesn't know anything?
Nothing.
Nothing?
He asks.
Nothing. Don't fuck with me, Murphy. I'm done with you screwing with my head. You know I actually started to care about you? What a freaking joke.
Emotion in his voice with these last words choking on them, shifting his weight from one foot to the other. He's upset, coming unraveled. Something I can use, maybe. I started to care about you too, I say.
Shut up! I don't want to hear that!
He takes another step closer to me. I can almost feel the bitterness radiating off him. His chest heaving now, shaking his head.
Why?
He asks.
Why did you do all this?
Do all what? I ask as calmly as I can. Try to catch a killer?
Because it's— Stop it! Is that how you want to play this? Even now, when there's nobody else here to hear your lies? Do you want me to put a bullet through your head? Because I'll do it. I swear I will.
The gun bobbing slightly. Do I have a move here? Dive to the ground and make him shoot wildly in the dark? Then I see it, over Noah's shoulder at the far end of the bedroom where the hallway meets the doorway. The beam of a flashlight searching along the floor. Justin, limping forward down the hallway. The swirling wind drowning out any noise he's making, at least for me, and probably for Noah too. At least I hope so. Stall. Stall for time, Murphy. You're the one who broke into the warehouse and stole those attorney files, aren't you? I ask.
Damn straight I am, he says. Guess I beat you to them.
Justin drawing closer. I'm willing myself not to look too closely at him, not to signal Noah. Keep that flashlight beam down, Justin, or Noah will see it. The flashlight turns off. Justin is at the threshold of the bedroom now, and the glow from the kerosene lamp is sufficient. But the closer he gets, the more likely it is Noah will hear him, no matter how violently the wind swirls through this balcony and into the bedroom. No matter how quietly Justin approaches, with long, tiptoe strides. Keep Noah talking. That was a nice move, I say, getting those lawyer files before I could. Something in Justin's hand, something long and thin. A golf club? A golf club. Are those the last remaining copies? I ask. You tell me, Murphy. Justin raising the golf club, holding it with two hands. How the hell should I know? I ask. Shut up, Noah spits. Just stop with all your bullshit. Justin is only a few steps away now. It's all I can do to pretend I don't see him, not to tense up, not to give away his presence. What bullshit? I ask. I said shut up! I'm done with this, Murphy. You know what's in those lawyer files. You've known all along. Justin stops, the club poised like a baseball bat, ready for the most important swing of his life. I have no idea what's in those files, I say. Noah does a double take, his head cocked, a hint of doubt crossing his face. Then his eyes suddenly become alert, and he spins to his right just as Justin swings the golf club. Chapter 118. All at once, Noah spins to his right and instinctively ducks. The violent swing of the golf club grazing the top of Noah's head before continuing its momentum and splintering the wood on the balcony doorway. Noah's gun hitting the other side of the doorway during his spin, falling from his hand onto the balcony floor. I lunge for the gun as Noah, stunned, falls against the opposite side of the doorway. I scoop up the gun in my hands and fall forward into the bedroom. Don't move, Noah, I say, jumping to my feet. Noah, dazed, has managed to remain upright. His woozy eyes drift over to me and his gun, his Glock, now in my hands, now pointed at him. Shit, he says. He touches the top of his head and finds blood on his fingers. Hands where I can see them, I say. Show me your palms. Or what? You'll shoot me? He has my gun, Justin says, still clutching the golf club with two hands like a weapon. He doesn't mean the revolver he lent me. That's stuffed in the back of my pants. That old 38 I showed you at my house? Justin says. Noah has it. He jumped me and took it off me. I look Noah over. In one jean's pocket, something. Some papers rolled up and shoved inside, the edges protruding. The other front pocket, unclear, but a slight bulge, which could be the 38 special. What are those papers in your pocket? I ask him. The lawyer papers, he snarls. In case you didn't believe I had them. And the other pocket? He shakes his head. Nothing. I threw Justin's gun in the front yard. Show me your palms, I say. The first second you don't, I shoot. Noah, his brows curled in a frown, shakes his head, a bemused laugh escaping from him as his eyes bore into me. You're good, Murphy. You're very good. I gotta give you that. But guess what? He takes a step toward me. Don't, Noah. Isaac's preparing warrants for your arrest as we speak. He goes on. For all the murders. All of them. Did you know that, Justin? Noah nods in Justin's direction. Does he know everything? Shut up, Noah. It's not gonna work. And you take one more step, I start shooting. He takes another step toward me, but slowly, still showing his palms. Pushing me, but not pushing me too far. Testing me. Why didn't you kill me when you had the chance? He asks. That night you broke into my house? You buzzed a bullet right past my ear, but you couldn't finish me off. That's enough, Noah. Why'd you get me out of prison? He says. Because your trial was unfair, I say, my voice shaking. My hands are shaking too. My trial was unfair. He lets out a bitter laugh. You kill, what, 8 people? But suddenly you care about the justice system? He takes another step. I fire a round into the floor near his feet. Noah jumps back, startled for a moment, but he quickly recovers. That's the second time you deliberately missed me, he says. Why, Murphy?
Why not kill me? Heat coming to his face now, the snarl returning. Why? So you could kill everyone I ever cared about and watch me suffer? His eyes are filling with tears now, his shoulders trembling. I don't know who you think you're fooling, I say. I didn't kill anybody. My mind racing, signals flying in all directions. He's screwing with you, Murphy. He always does this. Anyone who could be this good for this long made a living out of mind-fucking people. He takes another step toward me. This time, I take a step back.
Jenna, what are you doing?
Justin says.
Yeah, Murphy, what are you doing?
Noah says, tears falling down his cheeks, his hands clenched in fists.
Aren't you gonna kill me? I'm taking you in.
Jenna, you heard what he said, says Justin. Isaac's gonna arrest you.
We know that's true. You heard Isaac say it himself at my house. Noah's gonna walk away from this.
Noah takes another step toward me, his eyes searching mine, pure bitterness in his expression. I take another step back, an earthquake inside my head.
You can't let him get away with this,
Justin cries.
He killed Melanie. He killed your uncle. He sent Aiden to my house to kill you.
Aiden. Aiden at Justin's house with a knife coming through the window. Noah shakes his head slowly, his eyes still on mine. Aiden. And then it happens. It comes to me all at once, just with the mention of Aiden's name. I can't be sure. I couldn't prove it in a court of law. But I think I finally figured it out. I fire another round into the floor. Noah jumps back again. His momentum temporarily stopped. I reach into the back of my pants and remove the revolver Justin lent me.
Justin, catch, I say.
Justin drops the golf club. I toss him his revolver, which he catches in both hands. Noah steadies himself, looks to his right. Justin is now pointing his revolver at Noah. Then Noah turns again and looks into my eyes, the odds against him mounting now. Me holding Noah's Glock, Justin holding his own revolver. Two people, two guns, two different angles. I search his eyes for an answer. Every time I've looked into those eyes, I've received mixed messages, a series of crisscrossing signals, heat and passion and rage and lust and pure hatred. My gun wavers as I replay everything in my head, sorting through it all, trying to make the puzzle pieces fit. Everything flying at me at once like a tornado.
Justin,
I say.
Yeah?
Aiden didn't come through your window to kill me.
What? What do you mean?
He asks. He came through that window to protect me, I say.
To protect me from you.
Chapter 119. Still facing Noah, the Glock in my hand still trained on him, I see in my peripheral vision Justin move the gun away from Noah toward me. I'm so tired, I say. I'm so tired of all of this.
You're not thinking clearly,
Justin says.
But all the same, keep that gun aimed at Noah. If it moves 1 inch toward me, it's a bad outcome for you.
It was you, I say.
You're the one who brought me to this house when I was a little girl. You and Holden the Sixth were gonna kill me. Your first murder together. Your initiation into the family or something, I don't know. But I do know that Aiden rescued me. For some reason, Aiden never told anyone about you. Maybe you held something over him. That bloody knife, I'd guess. The one with Aiden's and my fingerprints on it. The one that killed Holden the Sixth. Justin doesn't say anything. I keep my eyes on Noah, who returns an intense stare. If I'm guessing, I continue. Aiden came here that day out of revenge, after Holden the Sixth killed his mother. He got his revenge. He killed Holden with that knife. And somehow you got hold of the knife, the murder weapon, and you held it over his head all these years. You threatened him, blackmailed him, whatever. Aiden would be easy to intimidate. He's practically a kid even now. Jenna. And then you grew up. The boy who tried to kill me that day became the man who's killed 8 people. Then, when I started getting close, when it became convenient to pin all these murders on Aiden, you tipped off Officer Ricketts about the whereabouts of the knife. How am I doing so far?
You're doing quite well, Detective.
Quite well. Justin moves a few steps closer. Now lower the gun and drop it, Jenna. Slowly, or I'll get nervous. Noah remains motionless, save for the drop of his jaw, as I do what Justin says. I lower the Glock to my side and let it fall from my hand.
You must have just figured this out, he says,
or you wouldn't have tossed me the gun.
You mentioned Aiden, I say. He wouldn't hurt me.
I know that now, and you just confirmed it.
I guess I did.
Quite true about Aiden. He's your hero, after all. The young lad who rescued the damsel in distress all those many years ago. Too bad you realized it after you tossed me this gun. Life's a game of inches, isn't it? If it had come to you just a few seconds earlier, I wouldn't be holding this gun. Oh, that's got a sting.
Justin moves behind me, keeping both Noah and me in his sight and positioning himself beyond our reach. The right move, strategically. He didn't get this far for this long without being smart.
For what it's worth, Justin says, I'd hope that tonight would end differently.
You wanted me to kill Aiden when I came here looking for him. You knew this was where I'd come to look for him. You wanted me to kill him to keep you clean. But you followed behind me with your other gun just in case it didn't work out that way.
But I sure didn't expect Noah, he says. The best laid plans and all.
Noah's jaw clenches. I look at his left front pocket. Was Justin right? Does Noah have Justin's other gun? The .38 special?
By the way, Noah, Justin says, in the future, if you think you've knocked someone unconscious, be sure they're not faking. Stick them with a pin or something. And if you're going to tie someone up with a rope, don't just bind their hands behind their back. Bind their feet, too. And then bind the feet and hands together. It makes it a lot harder to get out.
Footsteps behind me as Justin presses the revolver into the base of my skull.
Not that it matters now, he says. But for the record, Jenna, I didn't want anything to happen to you. You may find this hard to believe, but I really did want us to be together.
I let out a bitter laugh.
I did. Think of how good we'd have been together. Think of our children. Holden's grandchildren.
I stifle the urge to vomit, the bile at my throat.
You're sick, I say. Everyone's sick, he spits, pushing the muzzle of his gun into the base of my skull, forcing my head forward. Everyone has it inside them. Some of us are a little more liberal about releasing it, that's all.
Noah is trembling, his eyes smoldering with pure hatred.
You killed Melanie, he growls. Right here in this room.
But that's not even the best part, says Justin.
The best part is you took the fall for it.
Just like old times with the schoolyard shooting.
You've always been a reliable fall guy, Noah. I've never properly thanked you for that. How have those hands healed up, by the way, from your fun at Sing Sing?
A furious, tortured smile plays on Noah's face.
You're gonna find out, he says, when I put them on your throat.
No, I think your hands are going on top of your head. And you're gonna move back toward the balcony. I know you have my .38 special on you. If you make me nervous, this gun goes off. You'll be wearing Jenna's face on your shirt.
Noah blinks, snaps out of his fury, looks at me, the gun shoved against my skull.
He backpedals from us, puts his hands on his head.
You'll never get away with this, I say.
Sure I will.
Sure I will.
The happy-go-lucky millionaire philanthropist who serves low-cost food to the middle class?
Everyone loves me.
Oh, and Jenna, he says.
Yes, Justin, I say evenly. He says it in a whisper.
After I kill you and Noah, I'm gonna find your Aunt Chloe and kill her too. She's gonna love our little fun room downstairs. I'm thinking shish kebab.
And then I feel the vibration against the back of my skull as Justin pulls the trigger. Chapter 120. Click. Justin pulls the trigger again. Another hollow click. I dive for the Glock I just dropped, sliding to the floor, then spinning back, faster than Justin can say, "Damn, this revolver must not be loaded." Thank you, Aiden, for emptying the bullets. Justin looks at the gun, then me, a bitter smile on his face. Then he shakes his head and throws the gun to the floor.
"No one will believe it," he says. "Like Noah said, Chief Marks already has arrest warrants out with your name on it. So the only way you'll get that justice you so richly seek is to shoot me."
I get to my feet, the gun steady now, aimed at Justin's chest. He raises his arms in surrender.
"How about it, detective? Are you gonna shoot an unarmed man?"
"Please, please," he says in a mocking plea, dropping to his knees.
"Don't shoot me, Ms. Murphy. Don't shoot me."
Sirens, in the distance, but not that distant. A 911 call, no doubt, after the gunshots I fired. Once Isaac heard that the shots came from the house on Seven Ocean Drive, he'd send the whole force. I lower the gun slightly, not so low as to give Justin any ideas, but not pointing it directly at him.
"You're not gonna do it," says Justin, as if disappointed.
"You're really not." His chest rises and falls, his face locked in a grimace. It hits me then. He wants to die. He doesn't want to spend his life in prison. Not one member of the Dahlquist clan ever spent a day in prison. He doesn't want to break the streak.
"My favorite was your uncle," he says,
"heating up that poker in the fireplace and driving it through his kidney." I shake my head. I'm not gonna let him beat me.
"Do you want to know what he said before I did it?"
The siren's getting closer, multiple squad cars approaching.
"He said, 'Help me, Jenna.' He was begging."
I close the distance between us, the gun aimed at his head.
"He was in so much pain," Justin says. I rear back, then drive my foot into his ribs, kicking him as hard as I can.
He doubles over on the floor.
"Pain like that?" I say.
He lets out a noise. Pain, yes, but also amusement.
It's the spirit," he manages. "I knew you had it in you."
"You're gonna rot in prison, Justin," I say.
"You don't get to go out in a blaze of glory, some dramatic suicide like all your ancestors."
Justin focuses on me with a hint of amusement. He gets himself to his hands and knees.
"My ancestors," he says.
"Shut up, Justin," Noah says, suddenly stepping forward.
"My ancestors."
Noah pulls the .38 special from his pocket and aims it at Justin.
"I'm warning you, Justin, shut up."
Justin lets out a wicked laugh.
"Oh, Jenna, you think Holden is my father?"
I look at Noah. "What's he talking about?"
"Nothing," Noah says.
"We'll talk about it later when everything's calmed down." I step back, instinctively separating myself from both of them.
"We'll talk about it now, Noah, and put down that gun."
"Murphy,
drop the gun, Noah, now. Slide it over to me."
The sound of tires squealing outside as the squad cars pull up to the mansion.
"Tell her, Noah,"
says Justin, regaining an upright position, still on his knees.
"Or better yet, show her those papers in your—"
Noah throws an uppercut, a violent left fist connecting just under Justin's chin, sending Justin off his knees and sprawling backward. Justin's head smacks the floor, and this time he's truly unconscious. No faking about it. Noah, with his back to me, the gun in his right hand. Don't move, Noah. Don't make a move. The sounds outside. Officers rushing through the gate, up the walk, the front door of the mansion slamming open. Footfalls downstairs. Their voices announcing their office, clearing each room on the lower level. My mind races, thoughts bouncing every which way, trying to make it fit. Noah. Noah. It was Noah all along? Noah is Holden's son? Everything spun upside down. Everything unraveled, like a fist coming down on a jigsaw puzzle, scattering the pieces in all directions. Tell me, Noah, I say, my voice shaking. Noah slowly bends down and places the gun on the floor. Though Justin is no longer a threat, he kicks the gun across the room for good measure. I want to see those papers, I say. His back still to me, Noah removes the papers from his pocket, rolled up like an ancient scroll, and turns to face me.
Put the gun down first, he says.
No chance. Toss them over. Noah drops his head, then starts walking over to me. Stop now, I say. Keep your distance and toss them to me. He looks up at me, not breaking stride.
Jenna,
he says. Stop, Noah, or I'll shoot. My gun is aimed at his face, my feet spread.
No,
he says. He draws closer to me. 5 steps. 3 steps. Footfalls on the stairs as officers race up to the second floor. I'll shoot, I say through my teeth.
You're not gonna shoot me, Jenna.
My finger is on the trigger as Noah's eyes lock on mine as I feel the familiar heat of his approach. And I can't. I can't pull the trigger. I don't know why. I don't know anything anymore. I just know I can't shoot him. Noah puts his hand over the barrel of my gun, his Glock, and pushes it down. He puts his forehead against mine.
It's okay now,
he says.
It's gonna be okay.
Tell me it wasn't you, I whisper. Tell me you aren't his son. Noah removes the gun from my hand. He replaces it with a scroll of papers, pressing them firmly into my palm. His mouth moves to my ear.
Holden didn't have a son,
he says.
He had a daughter.
Chapter 121. Here, it sucks, but it's hot. Officer Lauren Ricketts places the styrofoam cup of coffee in front of me in the interview room at the substation. When I look up to thank her, I see black spots, and I feel the weight under my eyes. Rough night, she says, rubbing my back. Tomorrow will be better. Tomorrow is today. It's past 5 in the morning. And no amount of tomorrows will change it. I look down again at the documents, still curved along the edges from having been rolled up in Noah's pocket for several hours. I read through them again, for at least the 20th time. The first page, a piece of stationery bearing the name Lincoln Investigative Services, a letter to Holden Dahlquist VI. You asked us to determine whether a woman named Gloria Willis of Bridgehampton, mother of Aiden Willis, gave birth to a second child approximately 8 years ago. Holden knew, or at least suspected, that he'd impregnated Aiden's mother. The answer to your question is yes. 8 years ago, Ms. Willis did give birth to a second child at Southampton Hospital, but left the hospital with her child only hours later, without filling out any paperwork. We believe that she abandoned this child later that evening at the Bridgehampton Police Substation. See attached news headline. I flip the page. The news clipping I saw myself at Aiden's house. Newborn abandoned at police station. The photo of Uncle Lang holding the baby at the substation in Bridgehampton. The next page, a photocopy of a handwritten note. The penmanship poor but legible. Please find my daughter a good home. She is in danger. Don't ever let her know about me. Don't ever let her try to find me or the father. He will kill her. My pulse banging like a gong, no matter how many times I read this note. A note from a terrified mother trying to protect her newborn daughter the only way she knew how. By abandoning her. I flip to the next page. A court document. At a term of the Family Court of the State of New York, held in and for the County of Suffolk at Riverhead, New York, in the matter of the adoption of a child known as Baby Girl X. I skip a bunch of the middle pages because they are legalese, just a bunch of lawyers' words. The punchline at the final page. It is hereby ordered that the petition of Gary and Lydia Murphy for the adoption of Baby Girl X, a person born on a date unknown at a location unknown, is allowed and approved, and it is further ordered that the name of the adoptive child shall be Jenna Rose Murphy, and that the adoptive child shall hereafter be known by that name. I can picture her. Of course, I can't in reality, but my brain isn't tracking reality now. I can picture my mother visiting Uncle Lang like they did every summer, taking me from Lang, holding me in her arms and saying, I'll love her. I'll love this child. A single tear falling onto the page, a thick circular stain in the corner. Still unable to believe it, though it makes all the sense in the world. My physical differences from my parents and brother, especially the red hair. My nickname, the red sheep of the family. Never quite feeling like I fit in. Sometimes we tell our children little white lies, Chloe said to me. She didn't tell me. None of them told me. Not Mom, not Dad, not Lang, not Chloe. They kept me in the dark to protect me. Protect me from whom they didn't know. A little white lie. And here I thought it was random. I thought I was a random victim at that house that day. When, in reality, Holden was trying to kill me to end the Dahlquist bloodline. First, he ran down Aiden's mother, my mother, with a car. Then he had Justin scoop me up and bring me to the house to finish the job. I would have died in that house if it weren't for Aiden coming to avenge his mother's death. Chief Isaac Marks pops his head in the door, measuring the look on my face before deeming it safe to enter.
Murphy,
he says,
we're done with Noah's interview. So you two are free to leave.
I nod and push myself out of the chair, my legs uncertain.
Murphy, I'm sorry,
he says.
I was a jerk. And I had you all wrong. I thought you were a loose cannon, hassling poor Aiden for no reason. And then I admit, for a time there,
You thought I was a serial killer. He throws up a hand. That's okay, I say. For a time there, I thought you were too. He laughs, which might, under the circumstances, be the best response of all.
When Noah showed me those investigative records,
he says,
and it turned out you were the daughter of, I thought you'd been playing me all along.
That's what Noah thought too.
Plus, your fingerprints on that knife.
I got it, I say. I may not like it, but I have so much emotion stirred up inside me right now, I don't have room for anger.
Justin's spilling like a volcano,
he says.
Now that we have him in custody, he won't shut up. He's proud of it. He says he's part of the legacy now. He'll go down in history, etc.
I'm sure he feels that way.
He told us about everything in 1994, too. Apparently, Holden saw you and your family walking to the beach one day, right past his house. He got one look at you, and I guess there's a strong resemblance to your biological mother. He followed you around the beach all day. Then he hired an investigator, and, well, you know the rest. You got the investigator's file right there. Then he had Justin snatch you up and bring you to the house.
Isaac, I say, raising a hand. I don't want to know the details. I don't remember, and I don't want to remember.
Sure. Yeah, sure, Murphy. Well, I'll see you next week then, if you're ready.
I shake my head. You need me to testify at the prelim?
That's not what I meant.
He places my badge and my gun on the table.
You don't think I'm gonna lose my best cop, do you?
He says.
I may be a horse's ass on occasion, but I'm not stupid.
Chapter 122. I walk to the cemetery on Main Street, the cemetery where Winston Dahlquist and his descendants are buried. The afternoon air is mild and smells of the rain this morning. Just down from the Dahlquist plot, Aiden Willis is busy planting flowers in a vase by some tombstone. Back at work already. Always the same. The raggedy shirt, the baseball cap turned backward, the scarecrow hair. He surely takes after his father, not his mother. Yesterday, the DA's office officially announced that it had no basis to proceed with murder charges against Aiden for the death of Holden VI. Aiden was too young at the time to have been charged as an adult, and the circumstances, they said, strongly suggest that his use of force was justified. That might be the understatement of the year. Aiden stops what he's doing when he sees me approach, squints at me. I don't really know what to say to him. I have no sense of family with him. We couldn't be less alike. We've never known each other. We've never shared a single thing, other than a mother. Hey, I say. His eyes scatter about as always, never holding a gaze.
You doing okay?
He asks me. Me? Yeah, sure. Listen, Aiden, I'm sorry for the way I treated you. I thought you were a part of this. I had no idea it was Justin. He nods, his eyes roaming around the ground at my feet. Did you? I ask, uncertain if I should even ask. All these murders, did you know it was him? His eyes go blank a moment, as if he's lost in a thought. More accurate, probably, to say lost in a feeling.
Didn't know for sure,
he says.
Couldn't ever prove nothing. Who'd believe me anyhow? I'm just a ditch digger. He's got all that money and shit.
And he had the knife you tossed out the window, I add. For a moment, Aiden's eyes focus, though not on me, looking off in the distance, his mouth forming a small O.
He said he kept it somewheres for safekeeping. Case I ever got any ideas, he said.
A not-so-subtle threat.
Don't mess with me. Justin was saying to Aiden, or the cops will suddenly find this bloody knife. Fuck with me, and I'll send you to prison.
He tortured Aiden. He made Aiden shoot up the schoolyard with him a year after Holden's death, one of the many things Justin has bragged about to the police. And who knows what else he said and did to him over the years. What about me? I ask. Did you know who I was? His eyes are still darting around, but a sheen of tears covers them. He shakes his head.
When you first came back to town, first time I saw you, you looked familiar, but I couldn't figure it. Then I finally remembered where I'd seen you from all that time ago when we was kids. That day at the Dahlquist house. I didn't know why you'd come back. Couldn't figure. But I didn't know that you were my... that we was...
The flowers, halfway in the vase, start to tip over. Aiden reaches for them. You should probably get back to your work, I say. Aiden fixes up the flowers, sets them down firmly, turns to me in his indirect, no eye contact way.
I was too young to know about you at the time. I'd have been only little when you was born. One time, when I was older, I saw a picture of her, with her belly.
I saw it too. The photo from the scrapbook with the baby bump.
She said the baby didn't live. She got real sad.
Probably the same thing that she told Holden VI, that I didn't live, that I was stillborn. A little white lie. To protect me, so Aiden wouldn't look for me, so Holden wouldn't look for me, so nobody would ever look for me. His darting eyes, just for a single moment, make contact with mine before skittering away again.
You look like her,
he says.
A good bit like her.
I'm lucky. She was very pretty and courageous. She did a brave thing for me. So did you, Aiden. If there's anything I can...
You want to see her grave?
He asks. I start to speak, but a lump fills my throat. I nod and follow him. It's a simple grave, farther to the south of the cemetery, an ordinary headstone kept up pristinely. Gloria Jane Willis, March 5th, 1964 to July 12th, 1994. Our beloved mother. Our beloved mother. Even though, for all practical purposes, Aiden was an only child. Even though, as far as he knew, I didn't survive the birth. Still, he included me. The sibling he never really had. The sibling he never knew. My, our, biological mother. The woman who gave me up to save me. A prostitute who surely wanted something better for herself and for her son. And for her daughter. July 12th, 1994. The day Gloria was killed in a hit and run. The day before the 7 hours of hell when I was plucked off the street and taken to Seven Ocean Drive so Holden could take my life too and end any vestige of the tortured, maniacal Dahlquist bloodline. I look over at Aiden, whose eyes have filled with tears.
I still miss her,
he says, his voice quaking.
You'd have liked her.
I know I would have. I take Aiden's hand in mine. But you still have family. You still have me. You're my hero, Aiden. And you're my brother. I lean over and kiss him on the cheek. He recoils slightly. I don't get the sense that a lot of women have kissed him in his life.
Okay,
he says awkwardly. His face brightens just a bit.
That'd be okay.
Chapter 123. I nestle my feet into the sand and let out a long sigh. The beach is utter chaos in mid-August. Kids running everywhere, boats and parasails and sandcastles. But to me, it feels like complete and total peace. 4 months, almost to the day since it all happened. 4 months since Justin's murderous ways were exposed and he was taken into custody. A now infamous killer who will go down in history with the legions of others. Someone told me they did a Google search on his name and got over 10,000 hits. Hooray for him.
Let's go watch,
says Noah, sitting next to me. Not sure I want to.
Oh, come on. Come on. You don't want to watch?
I relent, pushing myself out of the sand, fitting my toes into my sandals, my fingers intertwined with Noah's. Your hair is getting long again, I say. Are you going back to Surfer Jesus?
Hey, be nice to me,
he says, squeezing my hand.
I've been through a lot. I've been shot at by a cop 2 different times.
But she intended to miss each time, I add.
So she says. So she says.
We climb onto the pavement of the parking lot and walk up Ocean Drive. A thick crowd is gathered at the gate of Seven Ocean Drive. A couple of news crews as well. It's been like that ever since everything happened. They say there was a spike in tourism this summer due to all the people who wanted to come see this house. So there will be a few people, some shop owners, who might be sorry to see what's about to happen. But I think most people will approve.
Just in time,
Noah says. The wrecking ball slams into the roof first. Crushing the slate inward, the spears and ornamental gargoyles disappearing in a satisfying rush. A collective gasp of awe from the crowd. They told me it will take hours to knock down the entire mansion. I told them I didn't care how long it took. I just wanted everything gone. The house, the tunnel and dungeon beneath, the carriage house. It's my property, after all. That's what all the lawyers concluded after reviewing the trust documents. The property went into trust because nobody knew that Holden the Sixth had left behind any offspring. So, now it's mine. It won't be for long. I wish I could open a museum or a shelter for battered women or something on this property, but This is prime real estate, and there are zoning laws designed to protect its value. So I've put this massive lot up for sale, hopefully to a nice family who will build a nice new house with a very different future. The realtors quoted me an estimate that's more money than I'd make in my lifetime, and far more money than I'll ever need. So I'll keep a fraction for myself and give the rest of the proceeds to Aiden Willis. Another whack from the wrecking ball, this time taking out the wraparound balcony, the master bedroom where so many people lost or took their lives. Centuries of horror gone with one crushing boom.
"I'm gonna miss that house," says Noah.
I laugh. It feels good to laugh. Odd, unusual, but good.
"But speaking of houses,"
he says,
"those rooms aren't gonna paint themselves."
Our new place, he means. Not far down the road from Uncle Lang's old house. A 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom in a nice, quiet spot. Quiet sounds good right about now. We co-sign the loan on the salaries of a newly promoted detective, first grade, and the owner of a new handyman business. Seeing this house, even in its deliciously beaten and battered form now, brings back everything from that final night. I lean into Noah. "You were that sure I wouldn't shoot you?" I ask. He cradles me with an arm.
"Oh, yeah,"
he says.
"It was clear that you were madly in love with me."
I smile to myself. I am, in fact, madly in love with this man. I watch the wrecking ball do its work. I said I didn't want to watch, but now I'm fixated. Now I have to see it. I have to see every single piece of limestone battered and knocked to the ground. I need to see every inch of earth turned over. Noah looks at me, sees the intensity in my face.
"You know what?"
he says.
"I changed my mind. This is boring. This house is old news. I want to go to our new house."
This man understands me sometimes better than I understand myself. "Me too," I say. We walk off hand in hand, leaning against each other, the sun beating down on us. Behind us, another boom, the sound of crushing rocks, another awed gasp from the crowd. But neither of us looks back.
Please continue listening for an excerpt from Cross Justice. Alex Cross goes home. When I saw the road sign that said we were 10 miles from Starksville, North Carolina, my breath turned shallow, my heartbeat sped up, and an irrationally dark and oppressive feeling came over me. My wife, Bree, was sitting in the passenger seat of our Ford Explorer and must have noticed.
"You okay, Alex?"
she asked. I tried to shrug the sensations off. Said, "A great novelist of North Carolina, Thomas Wolfe, wrote that you can't go home again. I'm just wondering if it's true."
"Why can't we go home again, Dad?"
Ali, my soon-to-be 7-year-old son, asked from the back seat. "It's just an expression," I said. "If you grow up in a small town and then move away to a big city, things are never the same when you go back. That's all."
"Oh,"
Ali said, and he returned to the game he was playing on his iPad. My 15-year-old daughter, Janie, who'd been sullen most of the long drive down from D.C., said,
"You've never been back here, Dad? Not once?"
"Nope," I replied, glancing in the rearview mirror. "Not in... how long, Nana?"
35 years,
said my tiny 90-something grandmother, Regina Cross. She sat in the back seat between my 2 kids, straining to look outside.
"We've kept in touch with the extended family, but things just never worked out to come back down."
"Until now," Bree said, and I could feel her gaze on me. My wife and I are both detectives with the D.C. Metro Police, and I knew I was being scrutinized by a pro. Really not wanting to reopen the discussion we'd been having the past few days, I said firmly, "The captain ordered us to take time off and get away, and blood is thicker than water."
"We could have gone to the beach,"
Bree sighed.
"Jamaica again." "I like Jamaica," Ali said. Instead, we're going to the mountains, I said.
How long will we have to be here?
Janie groaned. As long as my cousin's trial lasts, I said.
That could be like a month, she cried.
Probably not, I said. But maybe.
God, Dad, how am I going to stay in any kind of shape for the fall season?
My daughter, a gifted track athlete, had become obsessive about her workout since winning a major race earlier in the summer. You're getting to work out twice a week with the AAU-sanctioned team out of Raleigh, I said. They come right to the high school track here to train at altitude. Your coach even said it would be good for you to run at altitude, so please, no more about your training. We've got it covered.
How much altitude is Starksville?
Ali asked.
Altitude, corrected Nana Mama,
a former English teacher and high school vice principal.
It means the height of something above the sea.
We'll be at least 2,000 feet above sea level, I said, and then I pointed up the road toward the vague silhouettes of mountains. Higher up there behind those ridges. Janie stayed quiet several moments, then said,
Is Stefan innocent?
I thought about the charges. Stefan Tate was a gym teacher accused of torturing and killing a 13-year-old boy named Rashawn Turnbull. He was also the son of my late mother's sister, and...
Dad,
Ali said,
is he innocent?
Scoochie thinks so, I replied.
I like Scoochie,
Janie said. I do too, I replied, glancing at Bree. So when she calls, I come. Naomi Scoochie Cross is the daughter of my late brother Aaron. Years ago, when Naomi was in law school at Duke University, she was kidnapped by a murderer and a sadist who called himself Casanova. I'd been blessed enough to find and rescue her, and the ordeal forged a bond between us that continues to this day. We passed a narrow field heavy with corn on our right, and a mature pine plantation on our left. Deep in my memory, I recognized the place and felt queasy because I knew that at the very far end of the cornfield, there would be a sign welcoming me back to a town that had torn my heart out, a place I'd spent a lifetime trying to forget. My niece was on the sidewalk in front of the county courthouse, arguing with an earnest-looking African-American man in a well-cut gray suit. Naomi wore a navy blue skirt and blazer and clutched a brown legal-size accordion file to her chest, and she was shaking her head firmly. I pulled over and parked, said, She looks busy. Why doesn't everyone wait here? I'll get directions to where we're staying. I climbed out into what was, by Washington, D.C. standards, a banner summer day. The humidity was surprisingly low, and there was a breeze blowing that carried with it the sound of my niece's voice.
Matt, are you going to fight every one of my motions?
Naomi demanded. Course I am, he said. It's my job, remember?
Your job should be to find the truth, she shot back.
I think we all know the truth, he replied, and then he looked over her shoulder at me. Naomi, I called. She turned and saw me, and her posture relaxed.
Alex!
Grinning, she trotted over, threw her arms around me, and said quietly,
Thank God you're here. This town is enough to drive me mad.
I came as soon as I could, I said. Where's Stefan?
Still in jail, she said. Judge is refusing to set any kind of bail.
Matt was studying us, or rather, me, intently. Is your friend the DA? I asked quietly.
Let me introduce you, she said. Rattle his chain.
Rattle away, I said. Naomi walked me over to him, said,
Assistant District Attorney Matthew Brady, this is my uncle and Stefan's cousin, Dr. Alex Cross, formerly of the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit and currently a special investigator with the Washington, D.C. Metro Police.
If Brady was impressed, he didn't show it, and he shook my hand with little enthusiasm. You're here why exactly? My family and I have been through a rough time lately, so we're on a little R&R to visit my roots and provide my cousin with some moral support. I said. Well, he sniffed and looked at Naomi. I think you should be thinking plea bargain if you want to give Mr. Tate moral support. Naomi smiled.
You can stick that idea where the sun don't shine.
Brady grinned pleasantly and held up his hands, palms out. Your call, but the way I see it, Naomi, you plea, and your client lives a life behind bars. You go to trial, and he most certainly gets the death penalty.
Goodbye, she said sweetly as she took my arm. We've got to be going.
Nice meeting you, I said. Likewise, Dr. Cross, he said and walked away. Kind of a cold fish, I said when he was out of earshot and we were heading back to my car.
He's gotten that way since law school, she said.
So you've got history?
Just old classmates,
Naomi said, then broke into a squeal of delight when Janie opened the Explorer's door and climbed out. In a few moments, everyone was out on the sidewalk hugging Naomi, who couldn't get over how tall and strong Janie had become, and got tears in her eyes when my grandmother kissed her.
You don't age, Nana,
Naomi said in wonder.
Is there a painting in the attic somewhere that shows your real age?
The picture of Regina Cross, Nana Mama chortled.
It's so good to see you all, Naomi said, and then her face fell slightly. I just wish it were under different circumstances.
My wife said,
we'll figure out the real story, get Stefan released, and have a nice vacation.
Naomi's face fell a little further.
That's easier said than done, Bree. But I know the aunties are waiting for us. Why don't you follow me? Can I drive with you, Scoochie?
Janie asked.
Of course you can,
Naomi said, and she pointed across the street.
I'm the little red Chevy there.
We left downtown and entered more residential neighborhoods, which were full of sharp contrasts. The houses were either run down or freshly painted. The cars were either brand new or about to fall apart, and the people we saw on the streets were either shabbily dressed or turned out in the latest urban attire. We drove onto the old arched bridge that spanned the Stark River Gorge. The granite walls of the gorge were 6 stories high and flanked the river, which was running fast and churning over huge boulders. Ali spotted kayakers down in the whitewater.
Can I do that? He cried.
Not on your life, Nana Mama said firmly.
Why not?
Because that gorge is a deadly place, she said. There's all sorts of phantom currents, and there are shelves and logs under that water. They'll trap you and never let you out.
Growing up, I knew at least 5 kids who died down there, including my little brother. Their bodies were never found.
Really?
Ali said.
Really?
Nana Mama said. Naomi kept on straight across the bridge. We bounced back over the railroad tracks into Burney, a very run-down section of town. The vast majority of the bungalows along the streets of Burney were desperately in need of TLC. Kids played in the red clay front yards, hounds bayed at our passing, chickens and goats scattered off the roads, and the adults sitting on the front stoops looked at us suspiciously, as if they were familiar with everyone who came to the starkest part of Starksville and knew we were strangers. That oppressive sense I'd suffered when I'd seen the sign to town returned. It became almost overpowering when Naomi turned onto Loop Street, a cracked and potholed road that ended in a cul-de-sac in front of the only 3 homes in the neighborhood that seemed well-maintained. The 3 bungalows were identical, and the paint looked recent. Each home boasted a low green picket fence around a watered lawn and flowers growing in beds by a screened-in front porch. I parked behind Naomi and hesitated in my seat when my wife and son got out. Nana Mama wasn't in any hurry either, and I caught the grim expression on her face in the mirror.
Alex,
Bree said, looking back in the passenger door.
Coming,
I said. I got out and helped my grandmother down. We went around the car slowly and then stopped, looking at the closest of the bungalows as if it held ghosts, which for us it did.
You've been here before, Dad?
Ali asked. I let my breath out slow, nodded, and said,
This is the house where Daddy grew up, son.
Land sakes, is that you here already, Aunt Regina?
A woman cried before Ali or any other member of my family could say anything. I took my eyes off the house where I'd lived as a boy and saw an old locomotive of a woman wearing a red floral print muumuu and bright green beach sandals charging off the porch next door.
She had a toothy smile and was shaking her hands overhead, as if she were bound for a revival tent in some of that old-time religion.
Connie Lou? Nana Mama cried. Young lady, I believe you've lost weight since you came to see me summer before last.
Connie Lou Parks was my mother's brother's widow. Aunt Connie had lost weight since we'd last seen her, but she was still built like a linebacker. When she heard my grandmother's praise, however, her ample body trembled with pleasure, and she wrapped Nana Mama in her arms and kissed her noisily on the cheek.
My God, Connie, Nana Mama said. There's no need to slobber.
My aunt thought that was hilarious and kissed her again. My grandmother got her to stop by asking,
How'd you lose the weight? I went on a cavewoman diet and started walking every day,
Aunt Connie declared proudly, and she laughed again.
Lost 47 pounds, and my diabetes numbers are better. Alex Cross, you come here now. Give me some sugar.
She threw open her arms and bear hugged me. Then she looked up at me with misted eyes.
Thank you for coming to help, Stefan. It means the world to us.
Of course, I didn't think twice about it, I said.
Sure you did, but that's understandable,
she said matter-of-factly, and then she went to embrace Bree and the children, gushing over each of them in turn. Nana Mama always said my Aunt Connie had never met a stranger. My grandmother was right. All my memories of her were filled with smiles and infectious laughter. When the greetings were done, Aunt Connie looked at me and then nodded at the bungalow.
You okay with staying in there? It's all been redone. You won't recognize a bit of it.
Dubious, I said. Nobody lives here now?
My Karen and her family, but they're down to the Gulf Coast, at least through the rest of the summer, caring for Pete's mother, who's in an awful poor way. I've talked to them. They want you to stay if you feel comfortable.
I glanced at Bree, who I could tell was weighing weeks of hotel costs against a free place to stay, and said, I'm comfortable with it. Aunt Connie smiled and hugged me.
Good. We'll get you moved in as soon as we get you fed. Who's hungry?
I am,
Ali said.
Hattie's laying out a spread over to her house, Connie Lou said. Let's get you somewhere you can wash up, and we'll have us a grand time and catch up proper-like.
My aunt was such a force of nature that Ali, Janie, and Naomi fell right in behind her when she rumbled off. Bree held out her hand to help Nana Mama and looked at me expectantly. I'll be right along, I said. I think I need to go in there alone the first time. I could tell my wife didn't quite understand. Of course, I told her very little about my boyhood because, really, my life began the day Nana Mama took me and my brothers in.
You do what you have to do,
Bree said. My grandmother gazed at me evenly, said,
You did nothing to cause any of it, you hear? That was out of your control, Alex Cross.
Nana Mama used to talk to me like this all the time in the first few years after I went to live with her, teaching me to divorce myself from the self-destruction of others, showing me there could be a better way forward. I know, Nana, I said, and I pushed open the gate. Walking up to the screened porch, however, I felt as strange and disconnected as I had ever been in my entire life. It was as if I were two people, a man who was a capable detective, a loving husband, and a devoted father who was heading toward a quiet little house in the south, and an unsure and fearful boy of 8, trudging toward a home that might be filled with music, love, and joy, or, just as easily, screaming, turmoil, and madness. This has been a Hachette Audio production of The Murder House. Written by James Patterson and David Ellis. Read by Therese Plummer and Jay Snyder. Produced by Cheryl Smith. Directed by Jared O'Connell. Recorded by Jake Baxter. Post-production by Beat Street Productions. The Murder House is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2015 by James Patterson.
Excerpt from Cross Justice, copyright 2015 by James Patterson. Audio production copyright 2015 Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.